Hello, and welcome to Arcane Connection. And today, we're going to be discussing the Hibernia book, on which, as it happens, I was one of the four authors. I'm joined today by Kevin Sides, and...
The Hibernia book. It is called The Contested Isle.
There's a reason for that. That was me hitting Kevin with a copy of Hibernia. But yeah, we're going to spend most of today hitting one another with books, screaming abuse, and hacking off the heads of one another's grogs and posting them by Redcap. Is that right, Kev?
Pretty much, yeah. I believe this is, of course, traditional in the Contested Isle Alternate Hibernia Tribunal, or Ireland.
Actually, naming it was a bit of an issue, because there were so many things you could call the book, and the names are always come up with by the authors, and it was always going to be subtitled The Hibernian Tribunal. Contested Isle, I think, was one of Matt Ryan's ideas. Matt Ryan is the person who drove the project. And what can you say? It sums it up quite well. It's not the catchiest of titles, I don't think.
I don't know. It's quite reasonable. It. And it summarises the plot quite well. I say the plot, the tribunal quite well.
So there's... Contested means to argue over, or to fight over, or to... Yeah, it implies a more violent, confrontational approach. And I think that
really... Tutelant would be my phrasing for it, but yeah.
Yeah, tutelant. So it summarises quite well what the book's about, because there's... When you're looking at medieval Ireland, you've got to forget everything you know about the history of Ireland post, you know, the 16th century. Forget all the stuff you know about... heroic nationalists and oppressive, you know, English and stuff like that, because it's a lot more complicated than that when we go back to early Ireland. And what you have got is the start of foreign intervention. Now, one of the big things for me was, who are the English?
Strongbow.
Yeah, Strongbow, who's actually French. You know, they're Anglo-Normans. You know, the Normans aren't really that English, are they? Well, I suppose they are, but...
Let's be fair, the Normans are French who've taken over England.
It's, yeah, they're French-speaking. You know, the aristocracy of England are French-speaking. So to blame the Anglo-Saxons for this is perhaps a bit harsh. Secondly, who are most of their troops? Well, as it happens...
They're
most
not English
of their men,
either.
Yeah, they're Welsh. Yeah. There's a hell of a lot of Welsh, and including Welsh longbowmen. And you've also got mercenaries from the Low Countries.
Yeah, Flemish.
Flemish
Franklin.
Mercenaries are always very popular in this period. And you've got... So you've got... An attack by the French with the Welsh and their Flemish allies, and maybe some English came along for the ride, on Ireland. And yet there is no united Ireland in this period. It's Hibernia.
Yeah.
And you've got four provinces, but those provinces, which are traditional areas, well, five if you include Meath or Mead, are also split into small kingdoms with warring kings. And the history from 1170... when Strongbow arrives and effectively sets up his own independent state, annoying Henry II badly.
Yeah.
And then Henry II comes over, sends King John to become Prince of Ireland. Well, that was a disaster, wasn't it? He started off by tugging the beards of the Irish kings and laughing at them. Fantastic. Diplomacy, style, tact.
When I was in school, having an archer for a history teacher did help in this, it must be said. But... I don't know if it's true or not, but apparently Strongbow was never sold in the side, for those who don't know, was never sold in Ireland because it was named after Strongbow.
Yeah, but I mean, actually, Strongbow's descendants and the descendants of the other Anglo-Norman, I suppose we'll call them, because as I said, English is the wrong word, the Anglo-Norman invaders, they were used English as a paraphrase.
Yeah.
Which I didn't think was a good...
Drops the word count.
But it makes us think of a much later period of Irish history. But the Anglo-Norman ones went on to become, in the famous words of one author or chronicler, more Irish than the Irish.
Yes.
And in fact, they were the people who, later on in history, provide a lot of the, you know, heroes of Irish nationalism. And I can't remember how many American presidents are related back to those Anglo-Norman Irish, but... I'm pretty sure that the Bush clan are. The Kennedys certainly were.
Yeah.
And if you go through your American history, you'll find a whole load of presidents are descended from these aristocrats who came over and carved out their own people. So what was the island they found like? Well, it was nothing like England. England by this time had market towns scattered roughly every 16 miles, a day's walk there and back, so you could go to market and get back.
Yeah.
And so you'd have villages, you know, going out and... there's a name for it, I can't remember the correct geographical designation from human geography for that settlement pattern. And you had a highly, well, a bastardly feudalised system. You had land owned by, everything was owned by somebody, at least in theory.
Yeah.
But there was still plenty of wilderness.
Hmm.
But in reality, Ireland's completely different. Ireland has got about 1,000 raths. I think they're called raths. That's how I'd say it in English, but no idea how you pronounce it in Gaelic. Any idea?
To be honest, my Gaelic is quite poor. Apologies to anybody who actually speaks Gaelic.
Yeah.
We will pronounce things completely wrong throughout this.
Yeah.
If we get anything right, do let us know.
But what they are little fortified villages. And in fact, there's over 1,000 fortified settlements in Ireland. And the whole patchwork of modern Irish archaeology of excavating these settlements is you've got often a wooden palisade and earthworks. Sometimes you've got a stone wall by this period. And they've got magnificent towers. And if there's one place in mythic Europe where you can find wizard's towers...
It's Ireland.
It's Ireland. Just Google 13th century towers or 12th century towers. Some of them are even older than that.
Mm.
And they build towers for defence all over the countryside. And so you've got farmsteads. They're not actually villages. They're large farmsteads. And they're fortified. And rather than having proper villages as we think of them, with a blacksmith, etc., etc., you have these farms who might trade amongst themselves and who own clan loyalties to a tribal king.
Mm.
So you've got no markets.
It was far more clan than feudal.
And that's absolutely.
12th, 13th century, people think feudal. This was clan.
Also, in England, you've got a pattern where the hinterlands of the ports, the actual, you know, around London, York, most of the cities are quite close to the coast. Now, in Ireland, that's true, because the only cities, Wicklow, Wexlow, Dublin, they're actually on the coast, and they were founded by the Ostmen. The Ostmen? The Vikings, the Norse, the Eastmen. And they'd actually, like everybody else who goes to Ireland, eventually managed to assimilate, like most people. I mean, you know, there was a later period of history when the Scots who were Irish are returned, but that's the 16th century. We're not going to get into that. In the period we're looking at, what's actually happened is for 50 years, the Anglo-Normans have tried to impose feudalism. And one of the big controversies when we wrote the book was playtesters kept writing back and saying, you know, I think they suspected that I was some kind of English nationalist bigot and hated the Irish Republic. Of course, it's absolute bollocks. I'm actually Danish, very proud of the fact that I'm Danish, so I am up with most of my life. And the reason that it was contentious, the thing I kept saying was prosperity. The new English towns are amazingly prosperous. You know, they're wealthier than their English equivalents.
Yeah, massively so.
Yeah, the Irish Exchequer is more than able to pay for Ireland and provide a healthy surplus for London.
Yeah.
So even then we were busy robbing the colonies. But this is the important bit. This is actually a historical fact. In the period 1200 to 1220, you are going through an unprecedented period of the development of markets. Now, that might not sound much to us, and I'm no historian of capitalism, but suddenly people can sell their produce.
Yeah.
You've got places, there are goods to be bought.
Yeah.
A lot of people are profiting from it, including the Irish.
Mm.
And the towns are doing really well of it. It's not robbing people, because there wasn't much to steal. It's the fact the Irish are naturally brilliant craftspeople, are managing to produce goods and sell them on an open market. And the development of markets and towns acts as a massive boost to Ireland. Their economy, in terms of modern economics, they're experiencing massive growth.
Yeah.
Then, of course, it all goes pear-shaped around about 1250, and Ireland becomes a drain on the Exchequer, and the whole thing goes, well...
Well, as you were saying earlier, the thing is, up until that point, they've been in small, effectively fortified farms, not even fortified villages.
Right.
And suddenly there's, okay, well, you know all that spare wool you've got? Come over here, we've got these.
But what comes with markets? Telegraph, road, dire straits, you know, so it sounds like here, because the settlers... The English have come along, a load of people have anglicised, have done very nicely out of it.
Yep.
Once you've got markets, you've got law.
Yes.
And the laws are not the Breton laws, the traditional laws of Ireland. The laws are English laws, and the sheriffs and justices who go over and start to set up assizes are not sympathetic to the native law, do not understand that it's a culturally sensible system in many ways that works in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
and in many cases they commit grave injustices. And so although this is a fantastic economic period, it's the loss of Irish national liberty.
Yeah, legally it's a horrible time.
And yeah, and I mean, it's by the time 1220, by the time the game is set, it's not in Connacht at all. Munster, parts of it, Meath is pretty much under the English. Leinster's very much under the English. Ulster, well, majority of it's under de Courcy, as I recall. So what you've got in this period is a conflict between the Irish, the traditional wild Irishmen, hiding out in the hills. No, they haven't got their whiskey yet. They haven't invented distilling. you've seen the Family Guy skit where they have flying cars, hoverboards, etc., etc., and then they invent whiskey and start fighting the whole thing, you know. Yeah, it's not quite like that. But yeah, so the brave heroic freedom fighters of this era, and I'm not making a comment on later politics here, I'm must stress that it's always
difficult. Talking about the 12th and 13th century.
The people there who are actually trying to maintain their traditional rights are very often the old aristocracy, the old warrior elite, the Fianna, or how you say it, Fianna's Fianna. Who go out into the woods and spend a bit of time outside of the clan, you know, and tribe, actually learning the art of being warriors. And they are raiding. And in 1209, there is a horrific incident when a group of newly arrived settlers are massacred on, I believe it's Easter Monday, Easter Monday 1209, outside of Dublin. And they were innocents. And the majority of settlers actually at Dublin that period came from Bristol. Bristol was the great port. And in Ireland, it's Wexlow. But, Wexford. What am I talking about? Wexlow. Wicklow and Wexford are getting muddled up in my head. It's Wexford. Yeah, you understand that it's easy to do when you're not looking at a book. So Wexford and that peninsula down there, the Wexford Peninsula, has become highly anglicised. Dublin is something of an armed camp because the two... There's the O'Tooles and the O'Byrnes, as the English call them. The I'm not going to try and pronounce the Gaelic names. I'll just embarrass myself. But the two clans are hiding out in the Wicklow Mountains. And, they are maintaining there. And so there's this conflict. And that's one level of conflict, obviously, between the newly developing towns and some of the towns. New Ross. New Ross is one of my favourites. It's up the river. I can't remember which river it's on. It's not on the Slaney.
Is it on the map?
Yeah, it's from the south. As you come up from Waterford, it's this river here, which isn't named. But yeah, it's on the map anyway. It's New Ross. New Ross was a pirate haven, and they would come down the river, past Waterford, out, past Perugian areas, now into the Bristol Channel. So piracy was rife, but it was an English town. You've got, you know, people who have seen the advantages of the English towns, and again, English, Anglo-Norman, and are doing everything they can. But then you've got this whole struggle that's been there from the beginning. When Strongbow came over, he was actually asked over, of course, by, let's not go into the whole history, but we all know he's brought over by an Irish king, who has been dispossessed and exiled and who's trying to reclaim Leinster. The whole story's in the book. But what's important is that Henry has to send his son and a large army to ensure that he doesn't set up his own state next to England. Which is why, you know, otherwise it would have been Strongbow's kingdom because he inherits the throne and his children. But then the Irish lords begin to fight amongst each other. And boy, do they go for it. And by that, by Irish lords, I don't mean the warring Irish kings. They've always fought amongst one another.
That's the tradition.
I mean the Anglo-Normans fight amongst each other. De Courcy starts fighting. And everybody gets involved. And as they carve out their liberties and their own areas, they are consistently arguing and fighting with one another. And plotting against each other. And the good news is, my favourite character of the period, William Marshall, sadly dead by 1220, but his son, also called William, Irish lord. And has, in fact, been innovating and building fantastic castles. And this is the period when Irish castle building...
They're proper fairy tale style, aren't they?
They're just
astonishingly well built.
Yeah, and they're technologically way ahead of those back in England. And that I find amazing. And I think it's because it's a frontier.
They had the money and they were more likely to get attacked.
Right. And the other thing you need to know, castles. The importance of a castle is In Ireland, in this period, the influence of the Anglo-Normans goes as far as the knights can ride
from the castle and back.
Do something and get back, yeah. So it's about a 30-mile radius around your castle that you've actually got any kind of administrative control over. Yeah.
Which means pretty much you're going to get a castle like every 50 to 60 miles.
Have you read the stuff on the Irish Church yet?
Yes, I have. And I always found it, because I actually know somebody who is Irish, which is sounds really racist when I say that. I actually know somebody who is Irish, and they actually told me that it is true that they actually technically had more saints than they had days in the year.
Yes, there's a lot of Irish saints. We included a lot of them in the books, and they are very odd. If you're not sure in what way I mean they're odd, well, have a look at
they're just unusual.
They're unusual, yeah. Have a look at the Irish saints. Have a look at their powers. They're a irascible bunch, prone to cursing and
they're not so much the friendly, pleasant, and now all of the fairies, all of the animals of the woods sort of flit up and land on your shoulders. And
they're not Francis of Assisi.
These are
warrior saints and heroes. They slay monsters, they free prisoners, and they damn well get up the noses of people in power. And no pesky magician's ever gonna win a fight with an Irish saint.
Yeah.
So the Irish saints are vitally important, but more than that, there's a struggle going on within the church. And the old Irish system is that of the Camarba. Again, I can't pronounce it in Gaelic, but you'll get the idea. So if St. Kevin here, St. Cogan, or however it's pronounced in Irish, set up his first monastery, sometime later, monks from there go and find the other end of Ireland and form another monastery.
Mm-hmm.
And all over the country, there are monasteries that are in lineages.
Yeah.
They're almost like hermetic houses in that respect. They're lineages of monasteries descended from who look back to the mother house.
Yeah.
And what's happened is, since the Anglo-Normans have arrived, the whole system in Ireland was... this might amaze you. Ireland didn't have many priests. In fact, almost no priests.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you think of Ireland, you think of Craggy Isle, you think of Father Ted, you think ass bit effect nuns, you think...
That's nowadays, and to be honest, that's not even nowadays. No. That's a stereotype.
Well, yeah, but Ireland, every Irish parish has a priest.
Yeah.
You don't have parishes.
Mm.
Camarbas, you have monks who serve the spiritual needs and act as priests.
Yeah.
But, you know, they can't technically officiate a mass, so only monks who have been ordained...
Can do masses,
but so they are effectively priests, but they are still monks.
Hmm.
And monks form the centre of many of these rafts, these little hamlets or villages I speak of. They're not really villages in the English sense.
Hmm. Like I said, they're more like, you know, fortified farm collections.
Yes, and some of them, like Clonmacnoise, have grown into large-scale almost towns, because you've got all of the lay brothers, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, who are labouring in the fields around.
Hmm.
And who work and live and observe the liturgical hours with the monks.
Yeah.
But they haven't taken a vow, so they can marry.
Yeah.
And that's quite an important aspect. So what happens is the Anglo-Normans turn up, and there's been a reform movement in the church who've looked to Rome and who've constantly tried to make the bishops more important.
Yeah.
Because the bishops are much less important in this period.
Yeah.
Or the period immediately before 1220 than the heads of the Camarba.
Well, the bishops are more like administrative head rather than religious. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's happened is the bishops have been brought in. Well, the bishops had a little influence. Bishops had spent most of the previous 100 years fighting one another, sometimes with actually armed men, but usually, occasionally with kidnapping. There's a great example in the book of this, the story of the Bishop of Waterford and his, the various attempts by his rivals to come to grab his land. But bishops are almost temporal lords. Bishops are now given clearly defined dioceses.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea. Bishops become the so you have cathedral cities develop.
Yeah.
Or cathedral towns. And the dioceses are then split up and the first parishes are being introduced. And the English, or the Anglo-Normans, build in Dublin a college for the training of priests.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly education becomes important, and they want priests in every village, and they are trying to get the Irish to move into villages and away from the traditional scattered farms within the woodland and meadow.
Traditional craft.
Yeah. So they are attempting to impose an English notion of countryside, and in fact, historically they eventually succeed, and that's why Ireland today
looks much like England today, to be honest.
It's greener, it rains a lot more,
and it's got a different language.
It's got plenty of wilderness. Yeah, yeah, but. at the end of the day, it's got that kind of village system and the parishes and all those priests.
Small parishes means lots and lots and lots of priests.
The actual fighting within the church, within the Dominion realm, is actually between those reformists who have allied themselves with the English system. And who want dioceses and bishops and that whole system of authoritarian.
Yeah.
And those who are following the older way, where it's a much more hereditary thing, where because a lot of monks were actually able to marry for a long time. I mean, don't forget, Rome is at this time still trying to impose clerical celibacy on its priesthood.
Yeah.
Monks don't generally marry outside of the Celtic areas, but in some Celtic areas, you know, you would have the head might actually be of a monastery, the abbot might actually be a manum, a lay brother.
Mm.
And therefore perfectly able to marry, and his children would take on the role.
Yeah.
And they're very often members of Irish royalty.
Yeah.
So there's a huge, there's another level of conflict there.
Mm.
So yeah, it's an exciting time. So what's happening with the Hermetic culture? Well, there's a final area of conflict, which I'm going to shut up after this so that Kev can talk. The conflict there is between those, not strictly just the Irish, those who favour the traditional Hibernian tribunal peripheral code and its way of doing things, which has a very odd feature. It has a load of odd features, but you know.
Not a standard tribunal.
Yeah, it's not a vanilla tribunal. But there is there's a definite conflict between those who favour the old tribunal system and the invaders. And the invaders aren't just invaders, because many of them are actually native-born Hibernian magi who want to move to something more like the continental model of, you know, the Rhine Tribunal or Stonehenge Tribunal.
Yeah, the more Hermetic norm, even though they're not.
Yeah, but they're going for Hermetic vanilla.
Yeah.
And so Kev, I've quickly gone through what I saw as some of the key themes of the book.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the Siege of Prisis is one of the key things, or Prisis. Mm. It was a covenant where foreign magi declared a wizard's war. And there's a really odd peculiarity in the Irish peripheral code that wizard's wars can be declared almost immediately and last for as long as you want.
Yeah.
There's none of this bothering to, you know, wait 30 days.
You don't need to wait until the new moon. You don't need to...
And wizard's wars carry on until one party's dead or submits. I mean, generally that's the way it works. Or they come to a negotiated agreement. There's also, we better throw it in quickly, the Quill Tree, Connaught, a whole quarter effectively of Hibernia.
Northwest quarter?
The northwest quarter, Connaught, is owned by the Quill Tree, which is a coalition of hedge wizards who are able to speak and are represented by representatives and delegates.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an ancient treaty,
in the book.
Yeah, it's Conmil Rae. But anyway, the ancient treaty, which is. And the Knockmill Ray, I think it's called, which means that they give a certain number of gifted apprentices every tribunal, and they are respected, and the Hermetic Magi stay out of collar.
Yeah.
And how long that's going to last now...
is pretty much down to the play characters in our campaigns.
Well, yeah, but anyway. So that's roughly the setup of the book as I understand it. I've just done it off the top of my head very quickly. I've probably made loads
25 minutes, keep going.
So, Colin, Kev, you've read the book.
This is first impressions.
Yeah.
It passes one copy over, would you?
Yeah. Yes. Right.
Okay. First impressions. The cover is another gorgeous picture. I have no idea who does these. I really ought to actually start learning the names. But it is a beautiful picture of, basically, to my eyesight, Hedgemage. It's got what looked like a couple of Irish war fans with him. There's some crows or something like that in the background. Absolutely stunning, beautiful picture.
It's very with posh the out standard.
Yeah, it's much more muted greys and browns rather than the normal sort of bright oranges and things.
But people could see the
but
cover.
But it is
online.
Actually beautiful. Yeah, the cover is online. I've no idea what the artist's name is. I could look it up, but I can't be bothered. There you go. Cover illustration, Christian Saint-Pierre.
Yeah, it's a great illustration.
Yeah. As Chris hasn't mentioned this. He's mentioned his name, he hasn't mentioned anybody else's. Mark Lawford, Matt Ryan, and Mark Shelley were the other three authors.
And it's Matt Ryan's baby, but Mark is a huge amount. I was the minor author.
Yeah, so we've actually got there, technically, one person from England, one Dane from England, which is Chris, one New Yorker, and another person from England.
Well,
so, weirdly,
Matt's Irish American.
Yes, but he's in America. He's in America, is my point. Yes. So we had nobody who actually was living in Ireland writing this book, which I think is quite funny.
Yeah.
I don't know how many Icelandic players there are in Ireland. That might be.
There are many.
There might be quite a few, but
yeah, there are some on the authors list. It's just they didn't go for the book. So.
Oh, there you go. So, yeah. But yes. So first impressions. It is a good looking book. I've got the hard copy. The hardcover. It is a good looking book. It is solidly built as normal. Just going through the contents page, history of Mythic Island, we've pretty much just done that and I really can't be bothered. Irish culture, it has interesting things like sex and marriage, hostages and forest fostering, hospitality, that kind of thing. So that's all good for your actual meeting of people and things, which is going to be one of the main components in pretty much any campaign, to be honest.
Yeah.
Hermetic culture, well, let's be honest, yeah, the pronunciation of that word I'm not going to try, it's Magnimalfa.
I could be wrong.
As we said, this is again not a vanilla tribunal, but you do have things in here. You've got the, correct me if I'm wrong, the magical beings of Ireland have a voice, not necessarily a vote.
Yeah, the fairies and tribunal. Dragons and giants. Are there any dragons? Well, the fairies and dragons.
There's
giants,
dragons so everywhere if you want a dragon. There's a dragon. Ah, slot, you know.
Ah, but good old Paddy, he drove the serpents out of Ireland.
Oh, but that's a serpent.
Yeah, no snakes. I don't know if dragons count as snakes. I don't think they do, actually.
You still get lizards in Ireland.
No, they
haven't. There you go. Yeah. But yes, you've even got Hermetic Irish terminology in here, which is going to be quite interesting to have a look at. But yeah, so you've got a very interesting sort of setup here. And then you've got the bits on the various provinces, which is Connaught, Leinster,
Munster, Meath.
Munster, Meath, or Mead. Ulster.
Ulster, yeah.
The actual,
or Ulaid? Something like that.
It's written Ulster.
Sorry, I couldn't resist that. Carry on.
And then, of course, you've got things about the Druids, the pronunciation, I guess.
Quilltree.
Quilltree
are the hedgeway tribe Connor.
Yep.
The ones we just mentioned.
Yep. Or Coiltree, as my brain says it. Of course, you've got bards, as in actual bards.
Yeah.
Which is quite nice, you know.
But there's a fairy landscape as well.
Information on Geirsa. Basically, the large bird that's not a bird. Magical races of Ireland. So you've got Morag, Firbolg. I have no idea what that says, but there you go. I'm giving up on that one. Pagan gods, the Tuatha De Danann. You've got all this stuff, and then of course you've got the divine landscape and the infernal landscape, and then it goes into the introduction.
Yeah, Captain so spread through the contents.
That's the
There's
contents.
There's not
match.
A lot on the infernal actually. It's quite interesting.
It's actually quite a short chapter.
Demons aren't fond of the island, and
weirdly, St. Patrick may have something to do with that.
Well, when you look at the Irish saints, you can see why demons are going to get their asses out of there.
Yeah.
Their influence is different. Demons work slightly differently, and their style is different within Hibernia for theological reasons, no doubt.
Mm.
But yeah.
But they're more, rather than, you know, we're going to now have this master plan that takes 50 years to unfold, it's, what should we do today, Job? Bob? I know, let's go and cause havoc over there. What's that? I don't know, it looks like a small village.
Yeah,
it's much more immediate gratification for demons rather than long-term gods.
Demons only do eat immediate gratification as far as I can work out with good minerals, but yeah. But yeah, they are fun. I mean, the Fae
looks good, to be honest. Yeah. I had a quick scan of that one. Yeah, that does look interesting. Again, it's not a hugely long chapter. It's like less than 10 pages.
Well,
but it is the thing is, there's a lot in there.
Yeah,
it's not, you know, we're not talking, it's like less than 10 pages and four of them are pictures. We're talking, yes, there's a lot of content in those
absolutely
pages.
Absolutely amazing amount of content. Matt did that.
And you've got a lot of information on the actual physical settings. So when I say, you know, when I say chapter 8 is the province of Munster, it starts on page 73 and ends on page 87. That, again, doesn't sound like that much, but there's loads in there. Every single chapter in this is full of detail. I'm sitting there and I'm going, I have evil ideas and I'm not even the DM for this game at the moment. So,
well, I think we're going to have to do another podcast on Hibernia, don't you? Because
I think, well, to be honest, I think we did do the little Google Hangout at 11:30 at night UK time. Which we had, I think, four people.
Yeah. Well, we'll do a discussion with the other authors.
We'll do a better advertised one with a bit more warning next time. And
let the other authors... We'll try and do a podcast with each of the authors so they actually get a chance to speak about what they think about the book.
Yeah, that would be good.
Right, well, thank you very much. This has been Arcane Connection, and I've been Chris, CJ.
And I've been Kevin.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye.